May it please the court, my name is Jim Dixon, and I am representing the petitioner, Chris Niemann. I would like to reserve 3 minutes on this. In the typical false imprisonment case, you have an inmate that says to the jail, "You've kept me here longer than what the law allowed, and so I'm bringing this claim." And out of those cases, we have a few rules that developed. One of those is that if the jailer is following a valid order, there is no liability for just enforcing that order. A second one is that
a valid court order.
What's that?
A valid court order.
Thank you. Yes. A second one related is that even if that valid court order contains legal errors, that there still is not going to be liability. The third is that DOC is not allowed to go ahead and change provisions in there, even if it believes it's incorrect. Now, the state relies a lot upon those principles, but they don't really apply in our case because our case is not the typical case. The argument here, as clear from the complaint, as clear from the document submitted, is that it was the Department of Corrections' actions in obtaining the unlawful court order that gave rise to the liability.
So what did Ambrose do wrong?
Ambrose
flagged it. She watched it. She flagged it to the prosecutor and said, "Time is running out." She's very transparent about that.
Yes, she was. But then time.
Does your claim rest on her conduct? Or just the second supervisor?
It also rests on her conduct.
So what did she do wrong?
What she did wrong is she submitted a violation order. And I got to say, these folks with Department of Corrections in this particular unit really understood the law better.
Right, sir.
Than
sometimes others.
To me, you're basically saying the Department of Corrections smarter than the judge. That could be true, but who has the final decision in something like this?
Exactly. But what we do have is we have the Department of Corrections that has a specialized unit that knows how the law operates.
Okay, but can you get back to the question?
Yes.
Ambrose.
And so,
was supervising pursuant to a valid court order. I'm trying to get you to the second supervisor because I don't see an error, and I want you to point it out to me. From Ambrose, she did have authority to supervise. She had an obligation to supervise. She thought he was not in compliance. She raised it to the prosecutor with an email that said, "Hey, time is running out."
Yes.
So what did she do wrong before we go to person number two?
Okay. What she did wrong is that it was perfectly appropriate to submit the violation report on December 7th.
That's what she did right. What did she do wrong,
sir? Was particularly appropriate to do that. What happened, though, is once she discovers that the prosecutor has not noted up a hearing, that there has been no hearing held, she had an obligation at that point to let the court know, "Hey, I submitted this violation report asking you to take action. I should let you know that no longer applies. We no longer have jurisdiction."
Right there. Where does she have a duty to do that?
It is essentially the duty to make an accurate representation to the court. And if something you have said—
Well, she did make an accurate representation to the court and to the prosecutor, and you're suggesting that there was a delay there, not so unusual, right, and that she had an affirmative duty to come forward. And I'm trying to figure out where Ambrose got that duty. Where's that come from?
It comes from candor to the court, and submitting something that is no longer correct needs to be brought to the court's
attention. How did
Ambrose
do that?
What's that?
How did Ambrose do that?
Ambrose submitted the report that said you should violate him and then recommended what the action should be. That was good up until the 11th. At the 11th, that was no longer correct. And so at that point, Ambrose should be saying, "Your Honor, I submitted something. The court should be aware that no longer is correct as we've lost jurisdiction on this case."
But how do you overcome Dress, which cites the statute that we asked you to be prepared to discuss?
Yes.
RCW 994A.585. That's referenced, of course, in Dress and says, even if a sentence is clearly erroneous, it's not the duty or role of the Department of Corrections to correct the error. Apropos of the other questions, I'm still hunting for the duty.
Sure. And what Dress and the other cases address is that after there is a valid court order, DOC does not have an obligation other than to potentially take this action that's listed under the statute. We're not to that stage yet.
Did Ambrose have the authority, wherewithal or otherwise, to directly contact the court?
Absolutely.
How would
DOC not have that ability?
To a law-trained individual who's responsible for filing things in court, what was wrong with that?
Again, after making a statement that is no longer accurate, at the very least, filing something with the court. If
he had the authority to file things on her own directly with the court,
she certainly had the ability to forward that to the prosecutor and make sure that
answering my question. She had no authority to directly intervene with the court because she's dealing with a law-trained person. She's like a cop who makes an arrest, and there's a proceeding in court and a judgment, and the person's on probation, and that individual cop sees the person violate the terms of their probation and reports it to the prosecutor. They have no authority to go directly to the court unless there's something here that I don't understand.
No, but again, it's whether it's directly to the court or it's submitting something through the prosecutor, something needs to be provided that now says, hey, that thing that I gave you before is not correct.
She did alert the prosecutor, the lawyer, that time was running out.
She did.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with letting the prosecutor know that. But having submitted something that was going to be given to the court, she now should have submitted something that would correct that. I would like to take a moment, though, just to step away.
I'm just looking at the clock. I think you've answered a question about the duty vis-a-vis Ambrose.
Right.
Are you going to talk about the duty vis-a-vis the second person?
Sahor.
Sahor. Is that how you pronounce it, Sahor?
I believe so.
Okay. And I'd like to talk about causation as well. So.
Okay. And part of what we're talking about right now seems to be the 1983 claim.
I'm talking about the Washington tort.
Okay. In Washington tort, there is no individual liability as to these folks, and it is collectively what DOC did.
Okay, mm-hmm. So fine. But why – can I talk about causation then? Can we move to causation? As I read this statute, they had authority. Even if we have authority, it does not impose a duty. I don't see where a duty has been imposed, and I don't think the Washington Supreme Court has interpreted this statute. But please correct me if I'm wrong. I asked about four questions there. Am I right that the state Supreme Court hasn't interpreted the statute?
The statute that applies after someone has been sentenced that this court directed us to?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, to my understanding, it is not applied.
Okay. So we're supposed to figure out what they would do. And here's my question for both of you. The Bender case cites to Kilcup, which is an old case, but I don't know why anything would have changed. It incorporates the causation requirement from the restatement of torts. And false imprisonment required is an act which directly or indirectly is the legal cause of confinement. And so it seems to me what the district court said here, again, I'm paraphrasing, is that the cause of this, and no one's attributing bad faith, but the prosecutor made a mistake, and the Superior Court didn't catch it or maybe repeated it, and the district court thought that's the legal cause of what happened here. So why wouldn't we say, since it seems to me that a fair read of what the two individuals, Ambrose and Sahor, did, is I think they were trying to be really careful. My read of the record is the first person realized that time was running out, was monitoring it closely, raised that to the prosecutor's attention, and that the second person actually delayed filing a petition, recognized that as its sentence end date had expired, was waiting to see what the court was going to do. I think following up on Judge Hawkins's point, they're waiting for the judge to tell them if they had authority. And that the cause of the problem here, the element that's failing, even if we spot you, that there's an implied duty that arises, why isn't there a failure of causation?
Because had the Department of Corrections done what it was supposed to do, which is advise the court of whether or not there is grounds for a violation, whether or not this person is subject to violation. Had they done that, there is a very good chance that the court would have correctly applied the law and said, I don't have authority to do anything here. I can't even hold a hearing, much less issue an order. And that didn't happen. And again, it's because Department of Corrections is seen as such an expert in this area with their own unit. They're advising the prosecutor as to what the law is.
Well,
this
in
is
fact,
what the
they got it right. The
DOC
got it right.
But
so
they
that's
didn't
why
get
we're,
it right.
That's why we're all jumping on where do they have the duty to come forward? We know from Washington case law, I think it's this, is it called the Stalter opinion? They have this duty if they know there's a problem. They don't have a duty under Washington law to go ferret out a problem, and they were waiting to see what the court was going to do.
Those cases deal with what happens after the court has issued an order. And this is a
forgive me for interrupting, but yes. I agree with you. I think it's a fair point, and I'm not going to push back on it except to say we're just federal judges trying to predict what the Washington court would do. And so we're looking at these are the data points we have, right? Okay. And the data points point strongly towards looking to see whether DOC responds, you know, reasonably. And it seems to me that both of the folks we're talking about on this record were being awfully cautious.
But is it reasonable if all of the material that you have in this, your manual that you have, says the court loses jurisdiction after a year? Is it reasonable at that point then to pretend that they don't know that, to not advise the court, to continue to go forward? They submitted a violation report, which the court believed it could act on. It believed that it could act on it because they submitted it. They did.
I'm misunderstanding. When they submitted it, by the time they submitted it, hadn't the court entered the order extending the period of time?
At the time at which they entered the order continuing, at that point they were way past due. So the first
I was asking. That's not what I was asking.
Okay.
So Ambrose acted at the time. We already go over this. At the time Ambrose raised her hand to say there's been a violation of the terms, there was a valid order in place. And she not only said there's a violation, but time's running out. Right. Okay. And then if you go to Sahor, I thought that I understood that she recognized there was a problem and waited to see what the court was going to do. Do I have that wrong?
No, you don't have that wrong. The problem is that she waited and then assumed that, in fact, okay, we can go forward because the court is going forward.
Well, that's a pretty good assumption.
That's a pretty good assumption. I mean,
but
she cannot supersede the court order.
But there wasn't a court order, and that's what I keep on coming back to.
Wasn't there a court order? What you're arguing is that there wasn't a valid court order, but there was a court order, unless I'm misunderstanding the chronology.
We have two different orders that we're talking about. At this point, initially in December, after jurisdiction has passed, at that point, there is no court order.
Right.
There is no jurisdiction. After jurisdiction is passed, it's gone.
Doesn't Washington case law support the idea that in this circumstance, the court continues to have jurisdiction, even though the order's expired? Am I wrong about that?
Well, for this,
start with an answer to my question. Am I wrong about that?
There is continuing jurisdiction as to financial obligations. However, the court—
But not as to conduct.
That absolutely correct. And it's very clear that at the one-year point, the court no longer has the authority to issue an order. Most of the orders that we talk about, it's sort of like, well, they got the standard range wrong, they got the offender score wrong, what have you. Here, it's not that there was an order in the error in the content of the order, but rather there simply was no authority to issue the order. it necessarily was void because there was no...
But, you know, that's not an argument that, it seems to me, devolves to someone in the Department of Corrections. I mean, you're saying, well, there's no authority to issue. The court was wrong, correct?
The court was wrong, and it relied upon what had been submitted by the Department of Corrections. And there was no correction to that Department of Corrections report.
Thank you.
Counsel, did you want to reserve some time because you're down to the dregs?
25 seconds, yes. If I could reserve.
You're over time. My colleagues are correct. So we're going to cut you off there, and we'll hear from opposing counsel. When you come back, we'll put a minute on the clock.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you for correcting me.
Other way. There you go.
May it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Joshua Scher representing the Washington Department of Corrections and its employees.
Would you, if you don't mind, begin your argument by answering my question about whether the court had, if you will, continuing jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor. It is our position that the state court did not have jurisdiction beyond the expiration pursuant to statute and that it got it wrong in terms of extending. And in fact, Mr. Niemann ultimately appealed the state court's decision and the Washington Court of Appeals reversed what the state court judge did.
Okay. Can you review the chronology? Because I want to make sure I have this right. We've been over Ambrose. I'm now focusing on Sahor. My understanding is when she inherited the case, the petition to revoke had already been filed. And Sahor, the record indicates she knew that, I think it's SED, sentence end date, is that what? Okay. Had expired, right? And she's basically watching it and recognizes that has happened. She's waiting to see what the court does on this previously filed petition. Is that right?
To an extent, Your Honor.
Okay, so what am I missing?
Let me walk the court through the chronology here with respect to Sahor. ER 105, we have a January 2022 court order extending jurisdiction by 6 months at that point. No incarceration yet. The matter is then ultimately transferred to Ms. Sahor 1 month later in February of 2022.
So she inherits it, and while it's already been, that's actually kind of worse for plaintiff. But anyway, so but when Sahor responds, There's certainly an email. I can call you the ER to your attention where Sahor recognizes that there's this lapse in jurisdiction. By the time she files, and this is the salient point, what I'm trying to get at, the Superior Court had acted and extended jurisdiction, purported to, and then she filed. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Could you just walk us through January 2022, they extend for 6 months.
Yes.
What happens next?
The matter is then noted by another individual, an employee named Bruner. That's, I believe, the email Your Honor was talking about. Right. Bruner says, the court has extended jurisdiction. We need to update our records and directs Ms. Sahor to notify the records office. The sentence end date has been extended. Ms. Sahor is then assigned the file, as Your Honor notes, and ultimately there are additional violations that Mr. Niemann engages in, and she fulfills her statutory duty to report those violations to the trial court, and she does so by filing the notices of violation. And importantly, Your Honors, in those notices of violation, which are at supplemental excerpts pages 4 and 7, Ms. Sahor notes the sentencing end date is now June 12th, 2022, pursuant to the court's order extending jurisdiction.
Right, and so that's were you finished?
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think we understand that, and so hence it seems to me there's two problems with the elements of this tort. One of them is duty. Where did the duty come from? There's certainly a statute that authorizes, but it doesn't. I guess one might argue that it impliedly suggests their duty, except that the Washington case law talks really clearly, I think, the published case law, not the unpublished case law. The published case law is clear that they don't have a duty to be ferreting out errors. But this is a long time. It's 400 days, so it's certainly very concerning for a federal court to say that there isn't a duty when the Washington State Supreme Court hasn't said that, at least on this fact pattern, where the DOC folks recognize there may be a problem. And so to play devil's advocate here, if we spot opposing counsel that there was a duty even if we did that, what about causation?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, the state does not concede there is a duty
in case law.
There's no causation either because DOC and its employees did not deprive Mr. Niemann of his liberty. It was the court order that deprived Mr. Niemann of his liberty. DOC provided accurate information to the state trial court, notices of violations that they are compelled to send to the prosecutor's office under Washington statute. And then the prosecutor's office acted accordingly, initially with the mistake when Ms. Ambrose sent the notices of asking the court to extend jurisdiction, and then ultimately asking the court to revoke Mr. Niemann's community custody, again, compounding the original error that the trial court conducted.
But by the time they filed the petition for to revoke, there was an order in place.
There was.
Right.
There was an order. And, Your Honor, what the appellant's argument would do in this case is turn corrections officers into pseudo-appellate judges who would be tasked of reviewing the validity of trial court orders and deciding whether they agree or disagree.
Right. My problem goes back, and that is the duty. So you read this statute, which is discussed in Dress and other cases, and it just says may. Statute says may, the cases say may. But it's kind of odd because you may do it, and you may do it if there's an error of law, and then you file with the Court of Appeals, but you try to work it out at the Superior Court level. You try to exhaust it. So it kind of inserts the corrections officer, or the department, I should say, the department, rather than the corrections officer, into this whole process. So if there's actual knowledge that there is a problem with the length of the sentence, is it your position that it doesn't matter vis-a-vis the Department of Corrections?
Yes, Your Honor, because actual knowledge, even a belief, is irrelevant. The DOC is required to follow the trial court's orders. And so even if a corrections officer knows in their heart or believes it to be that the trial court acted inappropriately, Washington case law makes it very clear, as is a panel of this court in the Stein case that we cited in our supplemental 28J letter, that DOC is obligated to follow the court orders.
But DOC could come forward. And it seems to me if we're positing actual knowledge, if we posited that and then 400 days went by, that would be a much heavier lift and much more concerning. One that it seems the Washington State Supreme Court might be needing to weigh in. On the facts here, it seems to me, given that there was a record of DOC, I think, being quite cautious, causation seems to be lacking. And I'm wondering why the state's position is to push for a ruling on duty. That's where there's actual knowledge. It seems like, as I said, a steeper hill.
Two points to that, Your Honor. First of all, we would point the court to the State v. Ballas decision that we provided a supplemental authority as well. In Ballas, you had a change in the law that affected Mr. Ballas's sentence. And what the court, the Washington court said in that case, this is a 2025 decision, DOC argues that what the officers knew was irrelevant because DOC is only authorized to carry out sentences, not correct them. We agree. What the officers knew, even if they knew it was wrong, and just like in Ballas, if the law had changed, if a statute was enacted and the trial court knew better than the corrections officers, that's not the corrections officer's role to second guess or supersede the court order. Something could have changed and the corrections officers wouldn't know.
But that's what I'm saying. On the facts of this case, it didn't change. And we had, and it's not a circumstance where we have a record that shows they just missed it and overlooked it. For me, that would be a much easier case. I think opposing counsel's stronger argument is that they didn't overlook it. They saw this was a problem. And then my characterization is they were cautious. They didn't file yet. But be that as it may, I suppose that people could differ about that. But if we talk about not the facts, but just a hypothetical, right, where we say, okay, they actually, a different world where they actually knew that they didn't have jurisdiction and went forward, to say that they didn't have a duty under that circumstance would be, I think, troubling, at least to one member of the panel. I'll just speak for myself, and I don't know where we'd come down on that. But on this circumstance, what we're reviewing is a district court order that said these DOC folks did not cause this problem. Could you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. That is correct. Three things happened here. The DOC was required by statute to report violations to the court. It discharged that duty. So then when we look at causation, what happened next? Accurate information was provided to the state court. That's step two. Step three, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge all got it wrong. And they extended jurisdiction, and they ultimately revoked Mr. Niemann's custody and incarcerated him. DOC's role in that process, both Ms. Ambrose and Ms. Sahor, they were not involved in the court's decision-making. What appellant frames as advocacy or obtaining an order should really be reframed as discharging their statutory responsibilities. They notified the prosecutor's office and indeed of a problem with what they believed jurisdiction to be expiring at. Prosecutor's office in turn took that information and went to the court. And then the court made its decision. In terms of the statute that this court asked us to address, the one ending in 585, Your Honor pointed out, it is discretionary. And in fact, the Washington Supreme Court points out in note 5 of the Broadaway decision, the department can petition the Washington Court of Appeals. And the statute uses the word may. In either event, the Washington Supreme Court recognizes that it is a discretionary statute.
Well, in the meantime, per Judge Hawkins's point, in the meantime, there's a court order. They'd have to follow the court order in the meantime.
Correct? Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And Mr. Niemann has remedies. Mr. Niemann, as he ultimately did, could have appealed that decision. He could have asked for reconsideration. There's a PRP. There's a habeas. There's all types of remedies available to Mr. Niemann.
Let me ask you about the false imprisonment claim. And Niemann says, well, under Bender, you basically have a Department of Corrections employee who plays a role in the court order. So therefore, that erases absolute immunity. And so analogizing to Bender, because both Ambrose and Sahore authored these notices of violation, which is the basic communication, do they lose their absolute immunity under Bender?
I don't believe the state's arguing absolute immunity. It's arguing the lack of a duty or causation. But regardless, Bender involved false information provided by law enforcement to obtain a warrant. In this case, there was never false information provided by DOC. Every single thing DOC said to the prosecutor and ultimately which was conveyed to the court by the prosecutor was accurate. That is what the record reflects in this case. There is nothing false, and that's what distinguishes Bender, Your Honor, as to the application of any sort of immunity for those acts. The Dress case actually supports the state's position because in Dress, you had an order that compelled DOC to release the incarcerant. And the court ultimately said in Dress, DOC, you should have followed the court order. You weren't free to interpret otherwise. In this case, we have the opposite effect of the court order. Instead of releasing the incarcerant, it ordered DOC to incarcerate the incarcerant. And DOC, again, using the same reasoning as in Dress, had to abide by that court order.
Are there further questions?
No.
Did the court want me to address the QI issue at all?
Not for my sake. No, I think we're wrapped up. Thank you, counsel.
All right. We ask the court to affirm the district court in all respects. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Counsel?
In regards to Bender, the ruling there related to the incomplete information being provided in the search warrant. And because the detective provided incomplete information, I would argue that it's somewhat analogous when you submit a violation report, ask the court to take action, but then you don't provide anything additional that says, oh, actually, the court cannot take action anymore. Finally, knowing that I have 30 seconds, I would just ask the court to consider, is this really a valid order? Is it a valid order when, in fact, the court did not have any jurisdiction to be holding a hearing, did not have any jurisdiction to be issuing an order? This isn't a mistake of law. This is a lack of legal process. And lack of legal process is what courts often look at in deciding if something is invalid.
Do you have case authority for the proposition that this was an invalid, the type of invalid process they're talking about in this case law?
The case law...
I mean, for purposes of this tort, sorry.
I'm sorry, ask that one more time.
I had several conversations with my law clerk about whether this is a valid legal process. And you're positing that it may not be because there was a lack of jurisdiction. And my question is, do you have case authority for that to support your view?
I do not have case authority that I can give to the court right now. I do.
Okay.
There is case authority that talks about a valid legal process.
Yes. Okay.
And valid legal process would assume that, in fact, the court has at least authority to hold a hearing or issue an order.
Thank you. Thank you both. Oh, did you have any question? No.
I was just thanking you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take that case under advisement.